This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the July 6th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. It's a new era in DRF Players Podcast history. We're actually using podcasting software to record the show today. And this time I actually remembered to hit the start button. We're joined at first by the usual crew, Mike Hogan and Jonathan Kinchin. How are you doing today, gentlemen?
Doing great, Pete. How are you?
Life good? JK?
Always good. Always good. I got a little spoiled, Pete. For a little while, you were doing the thing. We talked about it. You were introducing Mike and then me, and I knew who was going to talk. And I think our technology changes might have thrown you off a little bit this morning.
I think that's to say the least. And I will say right now, we're basically odds on to have the next lost edition of the DRF Players Podcast. As many folks know, the greatest show we ever did was out in Santa Anita. I think it was over Preakness weekend, or maybe it was even before that, and we did this whole show. We were all amazing. We got off amazing lines. We each picked double-digit winners, and the show didn't record. So this could be the second one, but if you're out there in podcast listening land and you're hearing it, that means everything went okay. We're going to spend the first 30 minutes of the show today catching up, talking about the weekend action, and closing the loop on some stuff we've talked about in recent podcasts. Then we're going to bring in special guest Gabby Gaudette because the people demanded it at the end of the show. Gabby has some big news she's going to be sharing with us and talking about at the end of today's show. But let's start off with some of that old business. I realize I was remiss, Jonathan, in not giving you a hard time about something that happened when we were out at Santa Anita recently. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, but I'm nervous.
Good, good. That's how I want it to be. We gave me deserved guff for the previous trip to Santa Anita for being vanned off, not being able to finish a dinner after the night of our webinar when perhaps I was a little bit overserved by our friends at Santa Anita. I'm going to suggest, however, that you, as a paddock scratch for dinner on Saturday night at Santa Anita, this time was even worse. Simply because I think we waited about half an hour for you to say goodbye personally to every single person who was hanging out in the Logan Suite on Saturday night before we headed to our nice dinner at Arroyo Chop House. And Duke Matisse and I just waiting at the door, rolling our eyes. Who's he saying goodbye to now? And then finally we get on the go and we're heading over there. You have your Uber and the text comes. You won't be making it to dinner after all. So I don't know, paddock scratch or vanned off. Mike, what's the bigger social faux pas?
Geez, I don't know. I bet it sounds like I got to make some of these trips out there because I'm missing out on all these details.
Vanned off is hard to bet back. Had a paddock scratch, you know, there's a lot of excuses there. I could have had a shoe come off or I just got a little hot or whatever. So
flipped in the paddock, got a little excited. Yeah, I hear you.
I will say my performance, you're right. I shouldn't have been bet back, but I did. I did perform admirably, I have to say, over that weekend. The other little bit of business I wanted to follow up on when we were talking to Michael Rona, did you have a chance to listen to the Michael Rona piece of the podcast last week, Jonathan? You won't hurt my feelings if you didn't.
No, I absolutely did. No, I was excited to hear that. It's funny. I think that announcers are one of the most underrated, appreciated, you know, part of our sport. I love announcers, and they tell the story. They navigate the story. It's the voice that I hear when I remember great moments. And so I'm always really interested whenever those guys kind of get to get out and talk a little bit about what they do.
He was great about the sort of art of it and how he puts his calls together. But we were talking also to him, of course, about his Seinfeld appearance. And thanks to listener Timothy Day, who I had a chance to hang out with for the Sunset Friday at Belmont last weekend, we got the details on what happened to Kramer in that episode, which we were neither Michael nor Mike nor I could remember while we were talking about it live. And it actually, unlike what we predicted, the story did have a happy ending for Kramer. He made the $18,000 betting on the horse at the OTB after he heard the tip on the subway. And it turned out that the cop posing as a blind violinist on the subway car prevented him from getting robbed by the angry mob who saw him over celebrating at OTB. And so he ended up getting to keep the money. So it, a rare happy ending for Kramer on Seinfeld. And the other thing I just wanted to point out was that whole episode is really good. I went back after Timothy gave me the sort of the scoop. I went back and looked and remembered that that was sort of one of the early seminal episodes of Seinfeld that's listed among the 20 best episodes of the entire, whatever it was, 10 or 12 year run of the show. So check it out if you can, the subway, some really funny horse racing stuff in there. I'm sure folks saw when Mike sent the clip around the other day. All right, let's talk about some racing. Enough nonsense to get us off to the start on this week's edition of the show, or this what is it? Is it Wednesday? This Wednesday edition of the pod. Let's talk about the Mother Goose. I have to say the panel from last Friday's show was did an excellent job. I was basically in moderator mode, so I'm not bragging on myself, but I will brag on the guests, both Jonathan and Mike, and also, maybe most impressive of all, Roger Satina, all giving out nice-priced winners. Hopefully, podcast listeners had a big weekend thanks to the job these folks did. Let's start by talking about the Mother Goose. Mike, I think it was you who gave out the winner here off the tracks. What did you think of the race in general?
Well, you know, I mean, it was a good performance by Off the Tracks. I was a little surprised to see her wire the field. I didn't expect her necessarily to be on the lead, but I didn't see it as a bad thing necessarily. And she looked good. Once she got into the stretch, I knew Jose had a little left in her, and it didn't seem like the rivals from behind were really going to pose much of a threat. And she drew away nicely. I think she's a good filly. She's fairly lightly raced. She's now 4-for-6 lifetime. That was her first graded stakes win with Todd Pletcher. It was her first grade one win, having won the Schuylerville as a 2-year-old in the Rod Rodriguez barn. But she's a good one. I think she's as good as, you know, in the conversation for as good a filly, 3-year-old filly as we have on the East Coast. Of course, Songbird is the leader for the whole division, but the East Coast Phillies this year, they're pretty strong.
Let's put a pin in the discussion of 3-year-old Phillies just for a second. I want to hear Jonathan's specific take on the Mother Goose, and then we'll tackle that division question for a minute. But Jonathan, what were your general thoughts on the Mother Goose?
I don't know. I mean, I thought it was really impressive. This is the type of performance that makes me fall in love with horses. On the lead, fast pace, hold off good horses. Like, I mean, it's one of those horses, like one of those types of performances that you can lean on this horse moving forward in a lot of other situations, because she's shown that she can overcome the negative pace setup. And when horses can overcome negative pace setups, especially when it's a negative pace setup for a horse who's on the front end, I really upgrade those horses. And so I thought this was a really impressive performance. Biased people might tell you the inside and the speed was pretty good at Belmont on Saturday, and I tend to agree with that a little bit. I think that might have helped her along. But nonetheless, what she did was pretty impressive. She's definitely one that I'd be looking for moving forward out of this race. I'm not really sure how she's going to stack up against Karina Mia and Songbird when and if that happens. But she's definitely a quality filly, and her performance on Saturday was pretty impressive.
You mentioned the name there, Jonathan, that I was going to mention when Mike was talking about the East Coast Division. To me, Karina Mia, just super-duper impressive in her last races. I would still be, from here, without looking at past performances or knowing the specifics of the race, siding with her over Off the Tracks in terms of that honor Mike was suggesting about the best East Coast 3-year-old filly. Where do you stand on that question?
I thought you were talking to Mike. My fault. I completely agree. I think Karina Mia. I was actually saving it. You've coached me up on our pre conversations of not arguing and saving it for the show. I was about to jump in on Mike when he said that when we were talking before the show started. I think Karina Mia is still much better than Off the Tracks, and I would definitely take her in a head to head situation when they finally match up against each other. I just think Karina Mia's races have just been super, super impressive. And like I said, with a little bit of a question mark about how the track was playing on Saturday, I'm going to need to see Off the Tracks do that on a track that might not have helped her out.
So, Mike, I'll kick it back to you and ask, is it just the 20 jelly beans you lost on Karina Mia back on the Derby weekend that's keeping you from exalting her to that upper level of the division? Or is there something else going on here?
Well, no, I mean, I look at it like this. In the Acorn, off the tracks, wasn't beaten too much by Karina Mia. Sure, she was better in that race, but I think off the tracks is an improving filly. You know, she beat or out-finished, at least in the Acorn, Catherine Sophia and Go Maggie Go, who are both pretty strong fillies. Off the tracks backed it up on Saturday in the Mother Goose. I think she's one. I think most people would agree with you that Karina Mia is the best on the East Coast. My point is off the tracks might not be that far behind her. And, you know, look, they're both fairly lightly raced, and I think we could still see the best from each of them, which is kind of an exciting proposition.
I agree. It's a very, very cool division, the way it's shaping up. Going to be very interesting to see. What is the latest word on Songbird? Are they still talking about heading east for the summertime, or have either of you heard a different plan?
I think they're still thinking those three races out east and then back to Santa Anita for the Breeders' Cup, and the three races being Coaching Club of America Oaks, as well as the Cotillion, and then
Alabama.
One other that's
Alabama.
Alabama, that's right.
How do you forget the Alabama? That's the big one.
I don't know.
But it's very
it's a holiday week. I'm still recovered.
Hey, I'm the guy who didn't hit record on the podcasting software, so I shouldn't be giving anybody a hard time. But it's it is interesting, and it's great to see that we have this interesting division, and we have, you know, anything can happen, but at least we have these dates to circle on the calendar for potentially mouthwatering clash between this interesting division. It's very cool. Now, Jonathan, you mentioned the way the track was playing potentially on Belmont Day in the Mother Goose. Is there any horse in particular? This is just, I didn't give you any time to prep for this, but is there any horse in particular that stands out to you as one who might have been against the track and the way that it was playing, who you might be looking for as a bet back, if not to beat these top fillies in their division, at least to maybe hit the board at a price?
Yeah, I mean, I would think you could give Lightstream and Rachel's Valentina another shot based on those performances. Rachel stumbled a little bit at the start. She was four wide throughout the turn. So she's probably one that I would want to give another shot back. The only thing about Rachel's Valentina is, and I know this seems a little bit trivial, but I think she's going to always in every situation that she's in. I don't feel like you'll ever get fair value on her. And especially in the bigger races when people find out that she is the daughter of Rachel Alexandra. So, but I think that she's definitely one that I would take a look at moving forward.
That's a really interesting point about Rachel's Valentina, and something I was going to bring up. I mean, at some point here, are we going to have to, I understand she's got her excuses, but at some point here, are we going to have to just look at her as one who maybe hasn't trained on and is always going to be over bet, who's going to be very hard to include on our tickets? Or do we think, because of the specifics of the excuses that she has built in, that would be foolish? Mike, what's your general approach to Rachel's Valentina as she comes back?
I think I'm going to look at her with a little bit of a suspect eye, especially if she keeps getting bet so heavily. Part of the reason why I was against her in the Mother Goose is she was coming off of, let's face it, a fairly disappointing effort in the Kentucky Oaks. And then she was bet down again as the favorite in the Mother Goose and had a disappointing effort. Those are the kinds of horses that I like to bet at a price. But if you're not going to get a price, and I don't expect we're likely to get too much of a price on Rachel's Valentina going forward, those are the kinds of horses that I like to bet against. You know, I love forgiving weak performances, but that's only when I get a nice, juicy odds. You're not seeing that with her. And it could very well be a case where she was a precocious filly that maybe hasn't improved as much as a three-year-old, and the rest of the division has caught up to her.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where she turns up yet next. I do suspect she might be more of a defensive use because of the excuses than something you can really sink your teeth into. But it would be great, wouldn't it, to see her come back and continue to flash some of that potential or show some development from that form she showed as a two-year-old. I mentioned before that we're using this podcasting software. I do have now like a canned laughter thing, but the canned laughter you're hearing in the background, folks, that's actually that's just ambient. That doesn't have anything to do with me hitting one of these buttons. Let me hit one and just see what it sounds like. I'll give you an idea so you can compare and contrast. Sounds like some good cheering we have there. We've got a lot of new bells and whistles in the podcasting software. Any further thoughts on the Mother Goose, gentlemen, before we move on to the Queen's Plate?
I will just say one other thing about Rachel's Valentina. I think she's a filly that might be in need of a little bit of class relief. I mean, after the debut, she's run in five consecutive grade ones. She's lost the last four. Granted, she faced Songbird in one, but then the other three, I mean, maybe the Ashland took too much out of her and she's just trying to recover. But I think a little class relief, get some confidence back in her, and maybe that's when we'll see a good performance again.
Do you think, Jonathan, there's a chance that's how she'll be campaigned, or do you think with what she's already worth and what she's accomplished, they're just going to be pedal to the metal with her?
Yeah, I think they'll probably be pedal to the metal. I mean, she's had some pretty good performances. She's shown that she's a quality horse. And I think that they'll probably keep her going in that direction, especially considering the connections. And there's really no reason. I mean, what's the point of dropping her? It's not like they need the money.
In that case, I'll bet against her every time. I mean, I don't know. She needs to convince me she's a grade one filly as a three-year-old.
All right, let's move on. All right, Jonathan, here's one for you, because I know you can relate to this based on some of the appearances you've made on Tom Quigley's show out at Santa Anita on weekends. You've been playing in contests where you gave out all these winners and ended up with some frustration in the contest itself. We've talked about why that is, especially in a live bankroll format. But how about our man Roger Satina, who comes on here, gives out this big price in Sir Dudley Diggs, ends up in contests on DRF tournaments, getting off the horse, and it ends up costing him big time. How does this happen? How does this happen to you top contest guys? You get off your picks in the heat of the moment there.
Well, I think the main reason that happens is because when you make the decision on, you know, Saturday morning or Sunday morning, when you're going on one of these shows, or even like we, you know, for us, when we were doing the podcast on a Friday morning, things change, typically the odds. And so when you're watching the tote board before and you see that Sir Dudley Diggs is 50-1, which you assume that he would be, but a horse that was 7-2 on the morning line is now 7-1. You feel as if you need to go in that direction because you're getting a lot of extra value for a horse that, in your opinion, might be more likely of a winner. But when it was 7-2 versus 15-1, you were okay with taking the 15-1. So I think that's kind of how it happens. Also, you kind of get new information. I mean, that happens to me a lot where throughout the day, you'll talk to other handicappers, you'll talk to other people, you'll talk to, you'll see some stuff on Twitter about so-and-so and so-and-so, and sometimes that can influence the decision as well. So it happens. It happens often, actually more often than not, if you can only imagine.
Do we know specifically, is that what happened to Roger? Did he end up getting off for theoretically more of an overlay? I know he was talking about it on Twitter.
He actually got off to take my horse, all for red. He said we talked a little off air, and he said he liked that horse as well. And I think in the heat of the moment thought he was a more likely winner, albeit at a shorter price. And, what are you going to do?
So basically it's your fault, Mike. Is that what you're saying?
It is. It is. I made too good of a case, I guess.
All right. Well, let's talk about the race itself. Mike, you were saying before the show, you weren't overly impressed with the form of the race, but you thought the winner was good enough, or what are your general thoughts on the race?
Well, I mean, I think it was a good race from a horse who seems to be on the improve and obviously seemed to like the Tapita surface up at Woodbine. But, you know, I'm not sure that any of these are going to be three-year-old colts or the one filly that ran. I don't think any of these are going to be players at the larger division away from Woodbine. I mean, it was a nice race. It's obviously a very prestigious race, but I wasn't overly impressed with the rest of the field.
Jonathan, did you have any takeaways from the Queen's Plate this year?
No, I mean, I thought Amy's Gizmo ran really well. I mean, I think that horse proved me wrong a little bit with the distance limitations. I think that that's a quality type of horse. I'm not sure if we'll see that horse come down here and maybe get in some grass races, or maybe they'll try the dirt. You know, Josie Carroll has been known to bring some of these synthetic horses down here and try the dirt. So, you know, I think that horse is one that I'd keep an eye on if I saw him south of the border. But I will say this, you know, Mike here once again has continued to impress me that he's one of the most rare trainers in the game. His personality, I get, he doesn't give the best view, and you know, he's just a guy. He's not as outgoing.
I don't know what's going on, Jonathan, but you're breaking up a bit. We're only getting like every couple of words of what you're saying there. I'm just filibustering for a second. We'll see. Maybe your connection will solidify. You could say I wasn't even sure who you were talking about there.
Oh, that's weird. Well, cut me off if it happens again. I was talking about Mike Hager, one of the trainers, I think, in America, and I think that it probably has something to do with his personality. He's not like Todd Pletcher in these interviews. And so I think it maybe might be a little bit harder for him to get some of the clients that Todd has. But he continues to impress me at all levels, at all surfaces, at all distances. And if I had a horse, I would have no problem sending it to Mike Maker.
We were talking last show about the tendency that a lot of handicappers have noticed over the years with Maker's ability to just put horses in the right places, find horses who will excel on another surface. He just shows it again and again. And yeah, that's an interesting theory. I never really thought about that, but there's this other aspect to the job, of course, in terms of attracting people who are going to have to spend big money. And I don't know. I mean, I can't even recall a Mike Maker interview that I've seen. So that makes sense that maybe, you know, maybe he's more interested in training horses than he is in being mediagenic, but it's not like it holds him back. I mean, he's got good clients, and he's just done an incredible amount of work with what he's got. And I don't mean to knock anybody who's polished in interviews or say that's why they're successful, but it's interesting to factor in a trainer's personality into the type of horses they may get. Mike, you're an aficionado of trainer stats. Is that something you ever think about when you're examining trainer stats, is sort of how their personality and the owners they get affect the stats that you're looking at on the page?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think the way I might do that is if I know that there's an owner that's very, very, hands-on, shall we say, and they like to maybe switch trainers quite a bit. They like to make the calls about placing their horses and which races, then I maybe will downgrade this trainer stats a little bit, compared to ones that let the trainers make the call. Let the trainers place the horses. And sometimes it depends. I mean, you might have the same trainer, and with certain owners, they have one tendency, and with other owners, they have another. But in general, you know, how mediagenic they are, how their personality, I usually don't let that factor into my betting too much.
That's actually a good segue. We've talked many times on the show derisively about this owner pick the spot concept and how very often it's a great way to find horses to bet against. Earlier this year, we had sort of the counter argument where, no inside info here, but just everything I was intuiting about Tepin running at Royal Ascot was that this was a potential owner pick the spot situation. One of my big examples was just having heard Mark Cassie on the Steve Bick show maybe 6 weeks before, talking about future plans for Tepin and not even mentioning Ascot is a possibility. So it made me think that, of course, she goes and wins impressively, just showing what kind of quality she is, and showing that I'm not going to cop to being wrong about that. I'm going to say that she's just so good, and the Cassie operation is so good, they went ahead and were able to win anyway. But that segues nicely just to talking about the Cassie barn and the amazing accomplishments that just keep rolling up this year. What was the final lowdown over the weekend, Mike? How many stakes did Mark Cassie win?
Well, Saturday and Sunday, I think he may have been shut out on Monday. So just on Saturday
freezing
and Sunday.
Cold. Freezing cold.
I know. They're the start of the cold streak. Saturday and Sunday, five graded stakes, five stakes. I think four of them might have been graded, one grade one, three different tracks, two countries. Pretty impressive weekend for Mark Cassie.
Jonathan, what do you make of a barn when they're going that hot? As a handicapper, does that just make you include every single one of their horses for the time being, or do you look at it in the bigger picture? What do you think of this impressive run by the Cassie barn?
It might be a mistake, but I don't typically upgrade horses because the barn's going hot. I will downgrade horses if the barn's going cold, but that's more of a, you know, there's something going around the barn. Some of the horses maybe got a cold or something like that. That's kind of why I'll downgrade on a cold situation, but hot, I don't really upgrade horses, but I will say it's pretty impressive. I've kind of got to talk about it a little bit here, but Travis Stone and Norm have become really good friends living in Louisville together. And I've got to hang out with Norm a few times and I see how hard those guys work and some of their frustrations from how tough Saratoga has been to them and to have the success that they're having right now on the biggest stage is really cool to see. And I look forward to kind of seeing how they can kind of transition their success from the spring into the summer, and maybe Saratoga will be a little bit better for them this year.
Norm, of course, Mark's son, assistant trainer Norm Cassie, who trains the Kentucky string of the operation. And that's a great point. They did certainly at the beginning of Saratoga last year get off to that cold start. Maybe they'll be able to have a Saratoga to remember this year. We've seen it so often. Sometimes barns take a little bit of time in their current iterations to really fire at all cylinders at a meet like Saratoga. It's just so tough. There's so much competition. But I think that'll be one of the storylines to be paying very close attention to as we go forward. Jonathan, did you make it out to Churchill on Saturday night where a couple of those stakes wins happened, I believe?
I did make it out. It was fun. Night racing at Churchill is amazing. If you've never been, it's one that I'd try to pencil in on the calendar at some point. It's just a cool vibe. The city kind of gets excited. They try to make it a little bit of a party, and racing under the lights is always something that has had a special place for me. And when I first started playing, it was Friday nights at Hollywood Park. I'd get home and it'd come on about 9 o'clock Texas time, I'd have six adult beverages and maybe cook a steak and just watch the races. So whenever the lights horses running, and it kind of gets me excited. So it was definitely fun to be out there. It was definitely fun to see Norm have the success they were having. So it was a good time for sure.
My lone night racing memory, the last time I went night racing, is other than harness, but for the flats, unfortunately, is not a good one. Had a very small share in a horse who was entered at the Meadowlands. It was a big horse, about 17 hands, a horse I've told some stories about on this show before. If folks want to do the detective work to see the jockey I'm going to be speaking ill of, you could do it on your own. I'm not going to go ahead and bash. But I swear when the jockey walked through the paddock and saw this horse who looked like he was ready to jump a hurdle but had enough speed and ability to run really well on the flat too, I swear he was scared. It was not a look you ever want to see on the face of your jockey. Didn't work out so well, but I think you're right. I need to get back and do some nighttime flat racing. In your time in the game, Mike Hogan, have you ever experienced racing under the lights?
Yeah, a little bit. Years ago, it was actually when we had our mare who foaled filly at Harris Farms. We took a trip down. We saw the filly. She was a few weeks old. Then we drove down Southern California. My wife and I, I think she may not have been my wife even yet at that point. We did the Santa Anita Los Alamitos doubleheader.
Nice.
So that's, you know, I think I knew before, but that's when it, you know, solidified. I think we got a keeper here. But that's I think that's really the only time I've done the night racing.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we should do that one of our trips to Santa Anita. We always seem to get sucked down into the dungeon. Jonathan, I'm going to let you tell the story of our attempt, eventually successful, to get Matt Bernier down there on the recent trip to Santa Anita.
Yeah, Matt, disappointingly, too, he's one of those panicked travelers where he likes to get to the airport extra early. And those guys are actually my pet peeve. I'm the one that gets there. If they don't board until 30 minutes before, I don't understand why I have to be there before that. They're not going to leave me. So I just, you know, I got TSA pre-check. I get there at the last minute. So Matt was fighting us pretty good. He wanted to get to the airport 3 hours early. And we eventually set him up with a ride to the airport. And then we convinced his ride that he had to come to the dungeon first. So he really didn't have a choice unless he wanted to try to call up a taxi or find an Uber. So we tricked him into it, but he came down. I think he enjoyed it.
He was a little distracted, but I do think he liked it. What I thought was so funny, I understood the Panic Traveler thing to a little bit. I could be sympathetic to that. But I was on the same plane. I just thought it was amazing, the lack of trust he showed in me. So, you know, we co-hosted the podcast all that time together. You got to know I'm not going to let you miss your flight, man. But it all worked out. We had a lot of fun hanging out. We had our extra 45 minutes in Burbank Airport, and I think his sort of a gesture of thanks and reconciliation to me was he bought me a beer sitting there in Bob Hope Airport. So it all worked out for the best. It was smooth sailing. But the dungeon is an interesting alternative to doing the proper doubleheader when you're... Jonathan, I know you got to go, and we have a guest to bring in. Just going to ask you before you go if you have any final thoughts for your piece of this edition of the DRF Players Pod.
No, it's a fun time. I saw someone tweet 10 days till Del Mar, and right when that happens is usually when Saratoga happens. So summer racing is upon us, and I'd start gearing up, getting ready for that. So good luck to everybody this weekend, or I guess I'll see you guys on Friday.
You'll be back on Friday, I hope. We'll go over some races and have some fun. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Now we're going to bring in our next guest. She's returning to the program. I have had more than one friend tell me, when are you going to bring Gabby back on the show? One in particular said, I've heard enough of Kinchin and Hogan and you. Definitely bring Gabby back as soon as you can. So popular demand, and with some exciting news. You probably know her from her fantastic work, whether it is in Maryland or down in Florida. You're going to be seeing a lot more of her this summer as a handicapper and reporter on the Saratoga Live show. She is fellow Saratoga Special Hall of Famer, Gabby Gaudette. Gabby, how are you doing today?
I'm doing lovely, as always. A beautiful introduction. Every time you make me feel like an absolute rock star here. But, you know, it's funny because I was talking to someone this morning and last night that we were both alum for the Saratoga Special. Now, everything comes full circle, and now I'm going back up there this summer. It's really, really exciting.
I was going to ask you that actually as the first question is, you'd already spent some time in the game before your time at the Special. For folks who don't know, it's a newspaper that runs in print and online just for the Saratoga meeting, run by Sean Clancy and his brother Joe and also Tom Law. Over the years, in addition to providing all kinds of excellent horse racing related content, it has proved a bit of a finishing school, training ground for a number of people, including two of the three in this podcast right now. And Gabby, I just wanted to ask if there was one lesson or anything in particular you felt like your experience working with those folks at the Saratoga Special helped you with.
I think it was a multitude of different things, to be honest, Pete. You know, that was the first opportunity in racing I ever really got in terms of media. And I think it just really shined a light on work ethic. You know, you had to go out there every morning. You had to get things done on a deadline. You had to go back to the office, edit till, you know, 12 o'clock in the morning and do it all over again. So I think, you know, you learn also interviewing skills. I am actually a very shy person by nature, and I've kind of cracked out of my shell just in terms of, you know, approaching people, trying to connect with people, interviewing people, because that's part of the job, obviously. I think that made me take huge strides in that direction, just having to go out, you know, interview Todd Fletcher, who I was extremely intimidated by at the time, and just go around the backside and, you know, interview kind of the stars of the sport.
That's awesome. So I'm going to jump in here, Gabby, and you know, it's been a while since, how many years has it been since you've been stationed in upstate New York and at Saratoga? Obviously, people that are familiar with your work are more familiar with your work at Gulfstream Park or at Laurel Park or that sort of thing. So you're going to be obviously following a population of horses that might be a little bit different. And as somebody that's a very physical handicapper, and relies heavily on your notes and formulator, How do you get up to speed with a lot of horses that you maybe haven't seen before, and how do you analyze those horses for the first time versus ones that you've already got notes on?
Well, the beauty of it is that being down in Florida for the winter, you do get a lot of the same horses that you'll see up in Saratoga. I know sometimes it's not the case with two-year-olds. A lot of the connections we see in South Florida, they wait on their two-year-olds and they bring them, you know, they start to expose them up in Saratoga. But other than that, you know, you look at your graded stakes horses, especially on the turf or even on the dirt, a lot of the same horses we'll see back up and upstate. At the same time, I try to do the legwork. I watch races every day from, you know, coast to coast or worldwide as well, just to keep up to speed, because I think that's something that's very important. You never want to get behind in terms of knowledge and, of course, paying attention to big races. But also, I think it was a similar transition going down to South Florida that I'll probably have going to Saratoga this summer, and that it might take me a week to really get in the groove of things. But you just apply the same knowledge that you have. I think the beauty of it is that I've had experience in the past trying to acclimate to different circuits. Going to Arlington was a huge transition, because not only were there people that I had no idea about, you know, because that was a couple years ago when I was first starting into this career. And then you also have the different surface you have to take into consideration, the synthetic track. So I think it's going to be very helpful that, A, I got to experience some of the horses down in South Florida over the winter, and B, I've had experience in the past making these types of transitions.
That's a good point. So this team that you guys have put together that you're a part of, it's an awfully impressive array of handicapping and broadcasting talent, from Jason Blewett, Andy Serling, Richard Migliori, Maggie Wolfendale, Tom Amos, and yourself. How do you see fitting in with the other members of the team, and what do you see your role as being part of the Saratoga Live broadcast?
You know, I think we kind of exposed this down in Florida with having the opportunity to work with Andy. So moving forward, I think what the schedule will be like, I'll probably do some Talking Horses shows a couple days a week, and then obviously doing the Saratoga Live in the afternoons. But, you know, you look at the reporters, and I've actually been able to work with Richard Migliori in the past. We did the Breeders' Cup Players Show this past fall. So I think it's good that some of us already have a rapport. I know Maggie from a very long time ago. We obviously are both products of Maryland trainers that have kind of gone our separate ways here. But, you know, I think Maggie's obviously very excellent physical handicapper. Richie does a fantastic job kind of leading horses into the gate on the shows so far. We have Andy. Jason is obviously a very good host. So I'm just hopefully going to be part of it, just analyzing races, showing, trying to, you know, give my perspective on different things, and just, you know, try to provide the public with as much information that I possibly can, at the same time having some fun in the meantime.
That's great. So tell me, you know, jumping into that team, obviously you've worked with Andy a little bit and you know some of the other ones, but being somewhat new on that team, what do you think the biggest challenge might be in terms of getting adjusted and hitting your stride out of the gate, as it were?
Well, I guess you guys mentioned it beforehand, maybe a little bit, just acclimating to a new circuit, you know, New York Racing Association. We get horses from Belmont and Aqueduct, just going up to a different racing circuit. But I think it's also getting into the groove with people that you work with. And that's very, very important. I go into the summer with a little bit of confidence, knowing that I've worked with Andy Serling, and like I said, we have that rapport in the past. I've worked with Richie, so that's good as well. But sometimes chemistry on air can be the biggest factor in making a show really work. And I think that's what the NYRA broadcast is so strong about it is because you have Jason, who's such a good host to Andy. You have Maggie, who's always, you know, ready to go in the paddock. They just have very good chemistry between all of the talent on Naira. So I think that's the most intimidating thing, is just from a chemistry perspective, trying to fit into the big scheme of things, because there's a lot of different people and a lot of different things going on.
The last time we had you on, Gabby, was before the Preakness Stakes. I was just curious to close the loop with you about the Triple Crown trail this year. Any just sort of general thoughts about how the Preakness and Belmont played out, and maybe a horse you're really looking forward to from the Triple Crown trail who's going to be competing this summer?
Well, you know, I guess it was you go to the Kentucky Derby, and you watching the Kentucky Derby, you're thinking, okay, well, this is going to be a huge year for Nyquist. Even going back and looking at the Florida Derby, it seems like so long ago in hindsight. But looking at, you know, the steady progression with Nyquist, and I still remain with the opinion that he ran a fast Derby, and he ran a brutally fast Preakness, and sometimes horses just can't recover from that. So I would say I'm looking forward to, you know, some of these older handicapped horses too, as we see, you know, horses like Frosted, or even if we see Nyquist come back as well. So it's going to be a great summer. I'm looking forward to the older handicapped division, and also some of these three-year-olds as we continue on throughout the summer.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention Frosted. He's a horse we talked about a little bit on the podcast, and he's one, obviously, off of that huge performance in the Met Mile. I think a lot of people are eager to see. What do you expect from him, not just this summer, but the rest of the year? And second question, if you owned him, would you keep him to a one turn, or would you stretch him out around two turns again?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because I do think he's a very versatile horse. And I think if you're an owner, you have so many options with him, and that's a good place to be in. I thought the Met Mile was a very, very strong race, the way he floated like that. I mean, it was one of the most visually impressive races we've seen this season. There kind of was a strong early pace in front of him too. I'm not taking anything away from his win, because it was obviously very, very impressive. But that's a great question, whether to keep him at one turn or stretch him out at two turns. I mean, maybe not fix what isn't broken. And that was a very strong performance at the Met Mile. So I would say that he's probably very, very strong going one turn distances.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question of opportunities, I guess, with him, right? I mean, don't you have to, when you win that impressively, you have his body of work, don't you have to be looking at a race like the Whitney next to him? I actually haven't seen what the published reports are. Mike, do you know what the specifics are of how that campaign is lined up to be?
I don't. But yeah, I would imagine those kinds of races are going to be on the docket. And you know, especially getting to Saratoga, there aren't really as many one turn mile opportunities, unless you want to wait for Belmont again. And I don't know if the horse is ready. I doubt they're going to do that. So, but it is
target wise, you know, you certainly you'd think that Cigar Mile at the end of the year fits the bill for that. But I feel like the money's to be made, and the reputation is to be enhanced between now and then, going the two turns. Though I agree with both of you guys, with as stellar as that race was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Gabby, before we let you go here today, let's get the full plug in for the Saratoga Live show. When are you guys going to be broadcasting during Saratoga? Is it going to be the 6 days of racing? And which shows do you expect to be on?
Well, I will be doing all of the Saratoga Live races in the afternoon. So they're 2-hour broadcasts on each racing day, and we do start it obviously on the 22nd of July on opening day. I'll also be doing several days of the week on Talking Horses, primarily with Andy. And I believe, looking at my schedule, I start that on opening day as well. And I'm scheduled to do maybe 3 or 4 times for opening week. So it's, you know, going to be a shift. We obviously have a lot of really, really strong talent, but that is the plan as it stands right now for the Saratoga Live show. So 2 hours each racing day towards the latter half of the card.
So I think like 4 o'clock probably typically they'll be starting. Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
And folks can catch that on the NAIRA site, I believe, definitely on MSG Plus, syndicated in some other markets around the country. Check your local listings there. I can't wait to see what this team comes up with. I think I will be at Saratoga. I'll be fortunate enough to be at Saratoga many of the days, but the DVR will be running to catch all the great work that that team is going to be up to. It should be a lot of fun. Also, of course, you can follow along the Saratoga meeting with our own crew at DRF Live. Lots of good opportunities to get the inside scoop on the Saratoga meeting. It's going to be starting on July 22nd and should be a lot of fun. Gabby, I will see you on opening day.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a great summer. I'm actually getting up there a few days early, so we're ready and willing to go there for opening day. But I absolutely can't wait. It can't come soon enough, so I'll see you up there, Pete.
Sounds good. Hey, Gabby, we'll talk to you soon. Mike, any closing thoughts before we close this edition of the DRF Players Pod?
No, I'm just excited for Saratoga, excited for Del Mar, excited for summer. It should be a fun summer of racing.
It's a great time of year. All right, so that's it for today's show. I'd like to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I'd like to thank Gabby Gaudette. Definitely want to thank the stalwart of the show, Mike Hogan, really the MVP in the podcast history, more appearances than anybody else by a whole lot. And, of course, most of all, want to thank all of you for joining us, for your Twitter questions, for your comments. Keep them coming. You've been listening to the DRF Players Podcast. We'll be back on Friday. May you win all your photos.